Detroit is known for many things. Cars, Motown, and oddly hefty pizza, to name a few. They're also home to one of America's best museums. We've done many shows over the years on exhibitions at the Detroit Institute of Arts, but even the greatest institutions have occasional blind spots. On View Now is the first major Native American exhibition there in three decades. Contemporary Anishinaabe art, a continuation, celebrates indigenous art from across the Great Lakes region through 60 artists and nearly 100 works. With only a few weeks remaining in the show's run, we recently caught up with the exhibition curator, Dr. Deneen De Quintal. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Welcome to Museum Confidential. We're so excited to talk about this show and give people an opportunity to hear about it in a few weeks before it goes away. So we're hoping people will find their way to the museum and see it. But talk about the kind of momentous occasion that having this work after so many years, decades really of not having work like this in a major exhibition has meant. You know, the show has been open for a while. You've gotten to see response to the show. You know, what's it been like kind of seeing people experiencing this thing that you put so much time and effort into?
It's been a great moment, especially for the institution, to see the reaction that so many of the visitors have had to contemporary Anishinaabe art, a continuation. I think the expectation was that people were going to be really excited about it and happy to see it, but it's been such an overwhelming response and an overwhelmingly positive response to seeing so many contemporary artists in one space and in one place, and to see the variety of mediums that the artists present.
So it's a pretty big survey. We're talking like 60 artists, maybe 90 works. What's the variety of materials that we'll see throughout this show?
So there's basketry, beadwork, birch bark, artistry, clothing, film, graphic design, jewelry, painting, and sculpture, and woodwork, sorry.
Quite a bit. People may not have a lot of familiarity with kind of the tribal affiliations of the Great Lakes and all this. And Anishinaabe, you know, has so many things kind of underneath it, you know, kind of falling into this category. Can you kind of give our listeners a sense of, we're talking Ottawa, we're talking Potawatomi, you know, all the kind of variations of representation in the show?
So that is, you know, Anishinaabe is a umbrella cultural linguistic term. And for this particular iteration of the exhibition, we hope to have more. We're focusing on Chippewa, Ottawa, and Potawatomi people of mostly the United States-based tribes in the Great Lakes region.
So what, you know, this word, a continuation, which is in the title, is very purposeful and has certain meaning. You know, what did you kind of want to relay with this kind of concept of a continuation?
There are multiple meanings, as you mentioned, Jeff. And the idea for the title of the exhibition came from one of our artist advisors, Jody Webster. And in her perspective, she wanted people to know that Anishinaabe have and continue to produce an amazing amount of art. And that was one aspect of the title. Another aspect of the title is it is a continuation. We hope to do this exhibition again in another form in the future. And also, I think that one of the main parts of having a continuation in the title is to show the continuity between historical and contemporary perspectives through artistry.
You know, I think when you say that, you know, a lot of people, one of the challenges sometimes with Indigenous artists, people have this real sense that it was kind of locked in the certain period of the past and it's not a vibrant living thing today. And I think that's kind of what you've really gotten at with this show. I also know that, you know, there's an attempt to, you know, engage with current tribal members through this show. Do you know, well, let me ask this. When you started out with this project, and, you know, people listening know that these are not something put together in weeks or months. These are year-long projects, getting these open. And now that it is, what's kind of your metric for success beyond, say, just like how many people come to a show? You know, you must have some, like, how do you know, like, did it work or did it not work? What do you use as kind of your barometer inside?
I think institutional-wise, it was the number, you know, how many bodies we get to through the door. And in part, our projected number was supposed to be 35,000 for the run of the exhibition. We hit 50,000 by the end. We've blown past it. But to go back to your question, like, you know, what is a model of success? I think that it's all of the visitors who are leaving their feedback and that are saying that this exhibition has changed their perception and conceptions of Native American art, not just Anishinaabe art, but Native American art in general. And as you mentioned, you know, looking at that creativity, you know, people expected to come through the doors and see a certain, you know, certain artwork or cultural or artistic form. And what they see really changes their mind and gives them a different perspective about what artistry can be and what it is and what our artists in the show have produced.
What kind of programming have you been doing related to the show since it opened over the past few months? What, you know, and what were you trying to achieve with that?
We've had a film component to the exhibition, showing one film each month. We started off by showing Star Wars and Anishinaabe Moen. And we also had a spotlight on one of the artists in the exhibition that has the film at the end. And we showed four of his short films. And this weekend, we actually have one of the artists coming back in, Nonimi, who will be doing a workshop tonight. And then tomorrow, he'll be introducing one of our films, Bad River. But there have been multiple components, mostly focused on film. But to end off the exhibition, we're going to have a Friday Night Live, which is something that the museum is well known for, where two of the artists, Constance Patton and Jonathan Thunder, are coming back in and doing a musical art interactive, which shows the connection between rap and Native American art.
So you mentioned Anishinaabe Moen, which is the language. Mm-hmm. And I, for one, didn't know Star Wars was available in that language. So that's kind of interesting in itself. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's quite an experience. But I also know that you made an effort, like in some of the didactics and labels, to make sure that that was also presented in that language as well. You know, when you came into this, how new were you to all of this at this point? You know, how much, you know, the curate, I think a lot of people think every curator knows everything about the thing they're going to do the minute they start it. But it's really, you know, people have certain expertise, and then you kind of have to, you're on a journey as well, kind of learning as well. You know, what was your kind of knowledge base for this work when it was first kind of presented to you?
We can actually look at Anishinaabe Moen. In part, all of the labels in the exhibition have been translated into Anishinaabe Moen, and they come first on our labels. And I learned a lot about the language itself working with our translator, Helen Faust. She basically explained that Anishinaabe Moen does not have a one-to-one word ratio when it comes to translation into English. And then she also explained that Anishinaabe Moen changes depending on the time of day. So I learned a little bit more and a lot more about the language. And I also learned about certain aspects of Anishinaabe culture I was unfamiliar with. And you're quite right. A lot of people expect curators to be familiar with every aspect of the work that they do, the shows that they produce. But, you know, being a curator of Native American art, you know, there's 576 at this point in time tribes in the United States of America. And at one point in time, it's not possible to be familiar with every aspect of every culture. So this was a great learning opportunity for me. I'm so grateful to our artist advisors, because that is one of the reasons that we had artist advisors, to be able to show and present the artworks from the perspective of Anishinaabe people. And that was an extremely important component of this exhibition. We also worked with a Anishinaabe graphic designer, and that comes through in the exhibition with the graphics as well. And having those multiple perspectives has helped us present what we do in contemporary Anishinaabe art, a continuation.
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Art Naps. When a work on paper, such as a photograph or a print, is on view and exposed to light for a given time, they're going to need a period of rest in darkness. We call these art naps, or at least we're trying to popularize the term. You want to show a work for 4 to 8 weeks? Well, then you're going to need to store that baby in the darkness for several months. Nap time, everybody. And it's not just the light. Much like when you sleep, regulating temperature and humidity can, for that work on paper, make all the difference. But maybe we're getting off track here. Give your art a nap. You'll be glad you did. In fact, you might even feel refreshed and replenished.
You've been at the DIAs for about, what, 7 years, something like that? And the previous native curator had left 6, 7 years before, so there was kind of a gap in there where there was not. Was it hard to kind of get that going again, meaning kind of reestablishing a footprint for this work, or was there already kind of a nice foundation to start from, you know, when you first came to the museum?
I think that it was a little bit of both, you know, having that gap between myself and my predecessor, there was a lot of work to do with the collection, and to be given the opportunity early on to present this contemporary artwork in this space, it provided a space in which to catch up on some of that work and make connections and rebuild connections to the community. And one of the reasons why we decided to focus on Anishinaabe artists was because the collection has such a deep history when it comes to having Anishinaabe cultural items in the collection. But for this particular exhibition, we chose to focus on contemporary art and to build connections with the artists working in the United States for this particular iteration of the show.
You know, we mentioned the variety of materials and works in the show, and there's quite a spectrum. I know you have a specific expertise in basketry. So when you have coming in with kind of a focus like that, do you start from there? Is that like a good entry point? You're like, hey, baskets are kind of my thing. That's a good spot for me to start with. Or is it kind of like, I kind of know that already. I'm going to dive into, you know, X, Y, Z, whatever the thing is. Do you seek out the unknown, or do you find the familiar as a way to kind of roll into a project like this more easily?
Well, I think that for this particular exhibition, it was quite different from the start. There were no themes going into the exhibition. The themes developed after we asked for the call for artworks. And so there wasn't a focus on a particular medium. There was a focus on the artist and seeing like what artists were willing to participate in the exhibition, and going from that point, getting the artworks together, sitting down with the artist advisors and our team here at the DIA, and figuring out how the artworks work together. And that's how we developed the themes for the exhibition, which is kind of unique because a lot of people start off with a theme and then recruit artists and artworks, but we did it a bit differently.
So you mentioned that the goal, you had a certain attendance goal, and that you pretty quickly kind of surpassed that, which I'm sure felt great. Why do you think that happened? Was that a sheer, it was like you tapped into an audience that you maybe didn't know was there, that had been wanting to see this material? Was it a feat of marketing alone? You know, like what was it that kind of caused that unexpected surge?
I think it was a combination of word of mouth and uniqueness, like the fact that we haven't had an exhibition along these lines in over 30 years. And the artistry itself, the majority of the labels were written by the artists themselves. So you get to learn about their artworks through their own words. And the labels are long. I've spoken to quite a few people that have come back multiple times to like go through each artwork, read the labels, and learn more about the artist and, you know, their perspective. And they tell their friends, and their friends tell their friends. And I think that is the element, like the word of mouth, people being so engaged with the exhibition, the artists themselves sharing that they're in the exhibition, and, you know, telling friends and family who tell other people. So I think it's a lot of it has been people coming, seeing something that they really enjoyed, and sharing that with their friends and their family.
You know, you've been doing this work for a while. It seems like we're in kind of some sort of golden age with Indigenous artwork in America, or at least it's getting more attention than ever. And there's so much, I mean, you're seeing this from everything from like the Venice Biennale to, you know, what's happening at the Whitney. So like Raven Half Moon is at the Whitney, all these different places where maybe there was never proper representation, and doors are finally opening and all these things. Is that for any specific reason? Is it just time? You know, do you feel that as well in your work, that there's just more Native and Indigenous shows around the country than, say, there were 15, 20, 30 years ago?
I can say, Jeff, that it's about time. You know, there, like, for curators of Native American art, we've known for a long period of time that this artwork is extremely important. And speaking of Raven Half Moon, she was one of the first purchases that I made when I came to the institution. So we have her in the collection. Jeffrey Gibson was at the Biennale. We were just gifted with one of his works for the collection as well. There have been a lot of people who have been interested in Native American art and artistry. And I'm happy that everyone else is catching up to what we've known for a long period of time. There's such like poignant and important stories that Native American artists have and continue to tell. And I'm happy that it's now being embraced by a wider audience.
This show ends on April 5th. We talked about the fact that, you know, we say continuation because this hopefully is just the beginning, or at least a part of a larger effort. You know, seeing the success of this, will there be any, you know, are we talking, you know, are we going to have to wait years for another thing? Do you kind of say, hey, you know, how's this going to, you mentioned collection, you know, the permanent collection displays, mm-hmm. Will those be changing kind of to reflect the obvious interest of this? Like, you know, when you see the success of this, it has to have some kind of longer tail in some way.
Yes, Jeff. Part of what we're doing and what I've been doing since my arrival is thinking about a reinstallation of the permanent collection. And our permanent collection has both contemporary and historical Native American art. And so from this show, we hope to acquire works that we can include in our reinstallation of the permanent galleries. And we also want to be able to refresh and renew the stories that are being told, put a lot of the artworks into context, and make sure that the Indigenous and Native American perspective are coming to the forefront of that reinstallation. And hopefully in the future, it won't be 30 years before we have another large exhibition of Native American art. And that's also something that the institution is thinking about at this point in time.
You know, the show is called Museum Confidential. We're always interested in talking about the origins of people's interest in museums. You know, were museums part of your life as a kid? Did you go to museums a lot as a young person? What was your first exposure to the museum world?
My first exposure, my family has lived in New York for a long period of time. So of course, the first exposure was to the Met and to other museums in the New York area. And I really didn't become more involved in the museum community until I started to do the research for my PhD, and that was in Southern New England, where I worked at and went to Native American museums. And so that is where my perspective is coming from, looking at how Native American people, Native American tribes have presented their identity and culture to the world and to the public. And I have had that as my foundation to what I do now.
You mentioned there's, you know, gosh, nearly 100 works in the show. And, you know, it's an impossible question to kind of pick favorites, but are there a couple that you kind of view as kind of cornerstones that kind of helped kind of craft the overall, like you mentioned, the theme as you're, you know, since you kind of came into it somewhat backwards, thinking about themes in reverse, were there a couple or two or three works that kind of helped gel together what you think this show represents?
The works in the show are amazing across the board. And like for the images that come through, I think that we chose Jonathan Thunder's Basil's Dream as the marquee image for the show because we felt it contextualized what we wanted the audience to see in the exhibition. And that was how Anishinaabe oral histories and narratives have continued and how the artists interpret it in a contemporary perspective. So the story continues, how Native American voices have taken historical aspects of their cultures and translated that into their artworks. So Jonathan Thunder comes to mind. You can see the influences on him and his artistry, which is both his Anishinaabe culture as well as rap, metal, and those different perspectives of as well. So that is one of the artworks that comes to mind when I think about the show and what we want audience to take from it.
And, you know, just for people, you know, it's an audio format, so it's hard to imagine. And talking about art on the radio is always weird. But, you know, we're looking at like a contemporary pool hall. There's a person on a skateboard, or a kid on a skateboard. There's a DJ in the background. There's someone on a typewriter. I mean, there's all these components here. So, you know, what I love about it, and what I love about contemporary Indigenous work is you look at it and you might not immediately think it's Indigenous, right? It's just a, you know, and it has, but it has all these Easter eggs peppered throughout it, you know, so you can really spend a lot of time digging through the pop cultural references, all these things, like you mentioned. Ultimately, as we kind of wrap up here, and we talked about, you know, your kind of personal metrics for whether this works or not, what's been kind of the most surprising thing on this journey for you? Because these are a journey. These curated shows really begin in some place and kind of end in some place. What's been really surprising to you?
Well, if we can go back to Jonathan's painting, because you did an amazing description of it. And the person on the typewriter is Basil Johnston, who Jonathan read while he was a child and who helped inform him about Anishinaabe oral histories and narratives. And then Jonathan's painting features the epic battle between Water Panther and Thunderbird in his perspective in a Minnesota pool hall with the DJ in the background. And I think what was enlightening to me during this journey is that how different we are, but how similar we are as well. You know, hearing that some of Jonathan's influences was Digital Underground and the Humpty Dance and Shock G. You know, those were my influences as well when I was growing up. And just to see those, how we might think we have different perspectives and lives, but when we come down to it, there are similar ways in which we have been exposed to life and how that comes together in this show and how many different perspectives we see within the exhibition and how a lot of people can relate to what the artists are speaking to and illustrating and how that makes us have a better perspective of what we go through and what other people go through as well.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about the station or the museum, visit publicradiotulsa.org or philbrook.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.